Hi, I'm Mark Kernian, and I teach chemistry.
Hi, I'm Jack Kernian, and I teach physics.
And welcome to the My Science podcast, where learning about chemistry and physics becomes what it always should have been, fun and interesting, yet serious and valuable.
Mark and I are identical twin brothers who started our careers as engineers and switched to science education more than 3 decades ago. That's over 60 years of combined experience teaching high school students about the amazing insights of the physical sciences. And we want to share that experience with you.
So if you have any comments or questions about today's podcast, send them to Kernian at myscience-prep.com. That's K-E-R-N-I-O-N at myscience-prep.com. We'd love to hear from you.
So without further delay, let's get into today's topic.
Cool.
It is the topic of inertia.
Inertia, wow.
So, Mark, I don't imagine that inertia is a topic that you discuss a lot in chemistry, but I bet you use the word in everyday language. At least that's what I'm guessing. What do you think the word inertia means, and how does it have, or does it have any role in chemistry as far as you know?
Yeah, I do talk about inertia in terms of a definition associated with things that have mass. Okay. And so, you know, a lot of people think when we talk about things in chemistry that matter, I should say, that matter is anything that has mass and volume. But the better definition I always say is anything that possesses inertia. And so what I tell my kids is that it's a resistance to change in motion.
Okay. So that's what we're going to kind of focus in on today. But I also wonder, have you ever heard as a chemistry teacher something called the inert gases?
I have, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. How about something like activation energy? In a sense, do you see how that might be related to kind of like an inertia in a system?
Sure, yeah.
And we'll go into the details of what that means soon, but
okay.
I think so. There are some aspects of chemistry, I think, that really are associated with the idea of inertia.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yep, it's not a foreign word.
Yeah, so the word inertia comes from the Latin. I don't know if you knew that. It means inactivity or idleness. And someone might say that inertia is like a description of a behavior, keep something from changing. You were talking about that before.
Right.
Like you, I know you're good at this. Like you might want to keep sitting on a couch watching TV, right?
Yeah.
Even though you probably should stop, you know, you just kind of keep on doing the same thing. Or even like large organizations like companies, if they have to make a really quick improvement to their product, the bigger the company is, the harder it is from like to turn on a dime, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Or have you ever, maybe you and Patty have a specific restaurant that you like to go to. Is there anything like where you, it's like a go-to place? Do you have anything like that?
Yeah. In Pittsburgh, we have a particular restaurant that we like to go to all the time. And it's so good that we, you know,
exactly. When
you start doing, going out, you think, well, we should go there.
Yeah. So that sort of behavior actually is correlated to a lot of what I'm going to talk about with inertia today. I would say like scientifically, inertia really is one of the most important ideas in the study of motion. So because it's so important, I think it's a good place for us to start on the physics aspects of it and so on.
Okay.
But before we go into the scientific details, I was wondering if you have any certain behaviors that you do on autopilot, like without questioning them as the best choices, other than the kind of going to the same restaurant. Do you do anything without thinking about it? You just kind of do it?
I think like in the evening, when you get tired, you end up, okay, I'm going to go sit on the couch and I'm going to watch a particular TV show because in the past you felt, you got relaxed when you did that kind of thing. So I want to relax again and I tend to repeat that behavior.
And I also noticed, because I've seen you when you're falling asleep watching TV, that you kind of nod off. You start like watching and your eyes get heavier and then eventually you fall asleep. And the difficulty of getting up after you've fallen asleep to go to bed has to be more than just going to bed before you fall asleep. At least I think it is. I don't know if you feel that way or not.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
I see what you're talking about.
Yeah. So I think there have been a couple of times I've seen, I want to bring over like a warm pan of water next to your hands just to
I've
see what would
happen.
I've
done that for you already.
I was going to bring some lipstick over and put it all over your face and everything. But the idea is that it's kind of inertia that kind of keeps you in that situation because it's just easier not to change what you're doing and not to move.
Right.
And actually, inertia has recently been in the news in the world of psychology. There's something called status quo bias. Have you ever heard that?
Not really, but I can imagine what it is now that we're talking about this stuff.
Exactly. Well, there's like this claim that evolutionarily, humans have adapted to kind of preserve their mental energy by not focusing in on things that might be kind of extraneous to their needs. So if you don't pay attention to everything, you're likely to just continue what you're doing mm-hmm. and be effective at it and so on. Mm-hmm. And that obviously is not going to be necessarily a good thing all the time, mm-hmm. but it might be something that more often than not might be beneficial to humans and so on.
Yeah, it's like keeping your focus.
Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah.
And that's positive most of the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, the idea of that social inertia actually has played a role. At least some people claim this in an article that I read in preparing for this podcast. Some people think that that actually played a role in the development of the Matrix movie series.
The Matrix?
Yeah. Isn't that, I mean, I know you've seen those movies,
yeah.
right? So, I mean, I don't know if it's something that you've ever thought about, like how can somebody come up with that idea? But it turns out that there was a philosopher named Robert Nozick who had a thought experiment on a thing called an experience machine.
Okay.
So I'm going to tell a little bit about that first and then a little twist on that to kind of give an indication of how inertia really plays a part in our social lives as well.
Okay.
So I'll ask you this question. Okay. Like this is what Nozick would ask. He said, like, if you were given the option to plug into a computer simulation that would offer you continuous enjoyment for the rest of your life, all you would do is be happy for the rest of your life, would you take that offer?
Hmm. Okay. Now I understand why... what you're talking about in terms of the Matrix, like
okay.
plugging in
yeah.
And then experiencing that kind of thing. If I knew that was the case, you know, that I knew that I was doing that, it wasn't something that someone did to me. My initial feeling is I probably wouldn't want to. But at the same time, I'm not sure why I wouldn't want to.
Well, you know, there's been some studies on this, and most people would not choose a simulation.
Mm-hmm.
They want to stick with the lives that they have and so
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
But there was another person who came up with a twist on this. He said, what would happen if you hear a knock on the door one morning and it's a scientist who's there and lets you know that you are, in fact, already in a simulation and have been there for your entire, quote, life.
Uh-huh.
And he gives you the option of either staying in the simulation or exiting it and having this non-simulated real life for the rest of your days. And that might be really different from the life in the simulation, maybe. Who knows? But mm-hmm. what would you choose then?
Well, in that particular case, I think you'd be venturing into like an unknown,
yeah.
you know? And
yeah.
so I know yeah. what this is like right
yeah.
now.
Uh-huh.
And I have no real idea about what it might be like when I'm not plugged in. Mm-hmm. That opposite thing seems a little bit different to me than the
it
other
is.
First scenario that you put forth.
Yeah.
Because I know what happiness is. But yeah, I agree. It would be hard to change.
And yeah. that's what the research shows, that most people would tend to stay in the simulation. That's what the research shows.
Yeah.
And so basically the main idea here is in both cases, there's a tendency to avoid change,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's kind of like where inertia comes into play.
Right.
So I'll come back to that socially in just a minute, but let's go back to science now. Okay. And
okay.
I was wondering if you knew who the first scientist was in the modern era to use the word inertia in a publication to help explain something about the physical world.
I mean, my initial guess is Newton, if that's modern enough. I'm not sure.
No, Newton's definitely modern.
Is he modern? Okay, so I would say Newton, but I'm not positive.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. Most people would say that, and I think it's because of a law that he wrote called the law of inertia.
Mm-hmm.
We'll describe that, and certainly that's related to what this scientist did, but it's not Newton.
Right.
And it's not even...
I had a feeling it wasn't.
And it's not even Galileo, because okay. Galileo did some stuff on inertia as well.
Okay.
But it's a contemporary of Galileo. His name was Johannes Kepler. He's German scientist.
Yeah, I've heard of Kepler.
And he was the first person to use the word inertia in a scientific way in the late 1960s, and it was actually published a little bit after that.
Okay.
But he was a contemporary of Galileo, who was an Italian astronomer. They were both born about 75 years before Isaac Newton. And they had, both of them, and Kepler and Galileo, had amazingly influential intellectual lives that spanned several things like, you know, mathematics and astronomy. But Kepler was interesting because he was also an astrologer.
Oh,
very
okay.
famous astrologer and so on.
Well, I'd heard that Newton, too, was into alcomy and
exactly.
things like that. So
yeah.
doesn't surprise me. Yeah.
And it wasn't unusual in those days to have a hand in lots of different sorts of things.
Right.
In fact, natural philosophy is what we now call science. They considered themselves philosophers in some ways.
That's right.
So now Kepler, this is the interesting part. Kepler's use of inertia differed from both Galileo and Newton. For Kepler, inertia opposed motion itself.
Oh, okay.
But for Galileo and Newton, inertia opposed changes to motion.
Yes.
And that's what you were indicating when you first talked about this. So you mm-hmm. do, I think, have a fundamental idea of what's going on. I want to mm-hmm. explore that a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But in Kepler's view, a force is like needed to get something that was at rest to now start moving. And then once it's moving, to kind of keep it moving.
Okay.
Now, this is similar to what Aristotle said about natural motion, which I'll describe later on as well. A long time ago, it's like 4th century BC, you know, mm-hmm. that things kind of don't want to move. They'd rather go to their resting places.
Okay.
And even though Kepler had that view, he varied and differed a lot from Aristotle and so many other things. So he was not really like an Aristotelian in that way. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he thought about just getting something to start moving. Okay. But when you look at another component of what Kepler said, it really, again, drastically differs. What he said was the greater the density of an object, the greater resistance to that motion. So if an object at rest is really, really dense and you try moving it, it's going to be more difficult to move a more dense object, like a hunk of gold or something.
That's kind of intuitive. You know, you would think that, I think anyway.
Yeah. And that part of it is something that Newton actually retains in his work. Mm-hmm. Not the part about just movement from something at rest, but as you see, there's more to it. But he still kept the idea that there's something about the object and the properties of the object that maybe increase the inertia of something and
right,
so on.
Right.
So that distinction between Kepler and Newton makes sense in terms of like not just, you know, getting something to move. But for Newton, as you're going to see, we talk about keeping something going as not needing any force. Okay, that's going to be kind of what the laws come out. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
that's
it does. The difference. Yes, yeah, there's a definite difference there that I see. Yep.
And let's take a look at those differences after a short break.
Hi, I'm Ben from the band Sonic Acrylic, who provided the music for this podcast. We just put out our new album, Alternates. Here's a clip from track 4, Disasteroid. That was Disasteroid off of our new album, Alternates. To hear more, go to Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, or anywhere else you like to listen. Or head on over to our website, sonicacrylic.com.
Definite difference there that I see. Yep.
Yeah, and Newton actually came up with this as a result of other people thinking about it as well. I mean, he certainly was really inventive, but other people had talked about this
idea. Well, he stood on the shoulders of giants,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, and one of those giants was Galileo, you okay. know? Mm-hmm. Galileo expressed his principle of inertia with a really famous thought experiment that you may have heard before. It's called the ramp experiment. And I don't know if you can picture like a bowling alley that has a ramp where the ball kind of comes back up to where you pick the ball back up again.
Yeah.
Imagine if there was a ramp on the other side of the alley that was exactly the same and was really super smooth. Mm-hmm. So we're going to try and eliminate friction here. If you had a ball that was started on one ramp, rolled down to the bottom of it, rolled across the alley and come up the other ramp, basically what he said was there's no reason to think that the initial height of the ball on one ramp wouldn't be the same as the final height on the other.
Okay.
You follow what I'm saying? Like, if you made it smoother and smoother and smoother, that statement would be more and more true.
So not just friction on the ramp itself, but even air friction? Things
everything.
Like everything,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, if you just get rid of friction in general, mm-hmm. the height of the original ramp and where the ball is will end up being the same height as the final. If you make it smoother and smoother and smoother, that would be more and more true.
Okay.
That makes sense? So then what he said was this. This is really interesting. What if we took the second ramp and just made it longer? You know, still at an angle, a shallower angle, just longer, took longer to get back up to the original height on the other side.
Okay.
If there really isn't any friction, then you would assume that it might take longer, but still get up to the same height that the original ball was on the other side ramp. Does that make sense?
Because it's overcoming gravity, the same amount of gravity?
Yeah, and the height that would get to would be the same as the original height because nothing's taking away any of its energy.
Yes. Yeah.
So it kind of has to get
the potential energy that it had is going to be retained or
that's
something.
That's what we would say nowadays. Mm-hmm. Yeah, something like that. Okay. But then he said, well, what if we just kept making it shallower and shallower and shallower on the second side so that the second side never actually goes up a ramp?
Okay.
What would happen to the ball then?
Continue to move?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's mm-hmm. the principle mm-hmm. of inertia that Galileo and then Newton kind of puts into play.
That makes sense.
It's not just inertia of getting something to move. It's inertia something has because when it's already moving, it wants to continue moving in a straight line. And so
it brings in the idea of like the change as
yes.
opposed to forces starting things. Or
exactly. That's right. Yeah. So I'm going to come back to some of this stuff about Newton in just a second. But I want to make sure that when it comes to Kepler, everybody understands that he was a supporter of what we call the Copernican idea that the Earth and planets revolve around the sun rather than the Aristotelian model that was accepted by the church. where the sun and the planets revolved around the Earth. You're familiar with that.
Yeah, geocentric versus heliocentric.
Right. And Copernicus was a heliocentrist, mm-hmm. which really went against a lot of what the church believed. And it really was a result of Aristotle's influence over like 2,000 years. Right. And that Copernican revolution was what's called a paradigm shift in the history of science. You know who came up with the word paradigm shift?
I did read a book, his last name was Kuhn,
right.
I think.
Thomas Kuhn. That's exactly right. And so we identify certain things that were so revolutionary, they changed the way we view, and you really couldn't look at it in the old way anymore, and this change was one that was talked about.
I remember reading the book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, when I was buying a car once.
Really?
And I was so interested, and I didn't pay any attention to the dealer. He got really mad at me.
That's hilarious. So, anyway, this idea of something changing and maybe making it hard to accept at the same time is exemplified here, because there was a ton of intellectual work and also human suffering that had to go into changing from the geocentric model to the heliocentric model. In fact, you may know of a Dominican friar named Giordano Bruno.
Sure.
Do you know what he did? What was his
Heard the name, okay. But not sure of the story.
You know, he was burned at the stake in Rome. It's in 1600. Okay, this is in the lifetime of Kepler. You have to keep this in mind. In part for his free-thinking attitude about Copernicus's ideas of heliocentrism. And it was, therefore, you can imagine, a tough time, but also an exciting time, because things were changing to be an astronomer, right?
Sure.
So when Kepler published his three-volume work called, and this is like the Latin way of saying it, Epitome Astronomae Copernicanae, which I like. It's translated in English to Summary of Copernican Astronomy. It was published in the years over 16, there was three volumes, over 1618 to 1621. And it was in one of those volumes that he first used the term inertia.
Okay.
So that's where that came from.
Okay.
And then these bedrock ideas eventually became, you know, a formal statement of the principle of inertia that Newton finally gave us in his famous book. And do you know the Latin
term for that one? Yeah, I know. That's Principia.
That's part of it, yeah. Okay. That's what everybody calls it now, okay? Right? The actual name in Latin is Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica.
Okay.
Or just commonly the Principia. It's like so famous. Right. That was published in 1687, so that's a long time after Copernicus was not around anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But even high school students learn about Newton's three laws of motion that come from that book, the first of which is commonly called the Law of Inertia. I would bet that you could probably state that, because it's such a famous...
Yeah.
How would you say it?
I'd say an object in motion tends to remain in motion, an object at rest tends to remain at rest.
Unless acted
upon by another force.
An external force. That's really a key thing.
Mm-hmm. Sure, it makes sense. I know. We tend to oftentimes neglect that end part in a lot of things. Talk about the speed of light.
Yeah.
You know, 3.0 × 10⁸ meters per second in a vacuum. You know, it's not just anywhere.
That's a really good point. I think we have to be really careful.
Yeah,
right?
And I think a lot of people run into problems because that's oftentimes like neglected. And scientists, I think, you have to be specific in terms of what you're saying. You just can't say anything.
I have to
be specific about it. Yeah.
Yeah. This kind of shows a difference between maybe being careful and not being careful about things. So there's a big drastic difference between Kepler and Newton, in the sense that it's that objects want to continue in motion, right? And so that's something we really want to focus in on. And in 1989, British physicist Julian Barber, he compared Kepler's concept of inertia to Newton's law by using two simple equations. The Newton version is the second law of motion, called F equals ma, right?
Mm-hmm.
Force equals mass times acceleration. But Kepler, in a sense, was implying that F equals mv.
Oh,
and does that make
velocity?
Yes. How would you compare velocity to acceleration?
Well, velocity is meters per second units wise, and acceleration is meters per second squared. So acceleration is the change in velocity.
Exactly.
So once again, the word change comes in, right?
That's exactly right. So. Mm-hmm. With Kepler's former notion, we have a different idea about what force is needed to do. And in Newton's version, we say, well, you have this state of motion. It will not change regardless of what it is unless there's an external force.
Right.
So even though they're both different equations, right, F equals mv, which we now, by the way, call momentum. Mm-hmm. Mv is called momentum now. And that's related to the second law as well by a concept called impulse. But we'll talk about that in another day. So although they both do talk about force, and they both have, something about motion in them, they do have something in common as well, What's besides force? What was the other thing in common? In
mass.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what kind of what you were talking about at the beginning of this, you know? Mm-hmm. And it turns out that for both scientists, mass was kind of like a quantifier for inertia. Mass is not inertia, but it's a way of quantifying that behavior. Mm-hmm. So the more mass you have, the more difficult it is to change the state of motion. Right. And so we refer to the mass in F equals MA, that's the Newton's second law, mm-hmm. as being the inertial mass.
I see.
There's another mass called gravitational mass, which is about when objects gravitationally attract each other.
Okay.
And for all intents and purposes, they always end up being exactly the same number. Mm-hmm. But technically, they're different in theory, you know?
Okay.
And we'll talk, again, that's one of the another important idea we'll talk about later, maybe in another podcast.
Okay.
But Newton basically said, in terms of a sentence, that this is what inertia was. It was a power of resisting by which every body, and this is the important part, as much as in it lies, endeavors to preserve its present state, whether it be at rest or moving uniformly forward in a straight line.
You're making me cry, to be honest with you, because I when people say something and it just like hits exactly the right point, you know, and says in such an eloquent kind of way, they can appreciate things a little bit more.
It's amazing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're basically saying that these are great men saying things that were historically important because they did it in a great way that nobody else did before.
That's right.
It's not easy, I guess, is what we're saying, too.
Yeah.
And so before we talk a little bit more about the great Johannes Kepler, let's take a little break.
This is Ben again from Sonic Acrylic. Really hope you enjoyed the clip we played at the last break. Going to play another one here for you off of track 6 on the album. This is called Forever. All right, that was a clip off of track 6, Forever. You can find more at Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Music, and wherever else you listen. Thanks.
Now, Kepler also made important contributions in a lot of other intellectual areas. Did you know that he termed he was the one who coined the term satellite? First person to use the term satellite.
Oh, wow.
Kind of neat, right?
In terms of like things out in outer space, satellites out there, not launching a satellite.
Not launching it, but like a moon is the satellite of the Earth or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. He also came up with three laws of planetary motion that supported the Copernican idea of the sun-centered system. And I don't know if you're familiar with these laws or not. Do you know them?
Kepler's laws. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't be able to rattle them off like I could rattle off Newton's laws.
Yeah, they're more famous, I think. Yeah. Well, these three laws, one of them is called like the law of ellipses, like an orbit of every planet is an ellipse. The sun's at one focal point.
Okay.
That planets sweep out equal areas and equal times. If you looked at it kind of from above, you can see how much area they're sweeping out. So in one month, they sweep out the same amount.
Okay.
And that made it was important because then, because they were elliptical orbits, the planet has to move at different speeds in different places. And all of these things you're going to say go against the Aristotelian notion that we'll describe just real soon here.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing had to do with the square of the orbital period of a satellite related to the cube of what we call its semi-major axis in an ellipse. If the circle is a type of an ellipse, the semi-major axis would be just the radius.
Right.
But with an ellipse, because it's squashed down, there are different distances to the focal points and so on.
You had me at satellite.
So anyway, here the point is, do you know how Kepler determined these laws?
I would guess by going out at night and looking through telescopes, the motion that was happening.
Well, they didn't have telescopes.
Well, Galileo
quite then.
Invented.
Yes, but it was just brand. Okay. There wasn't a lot of data available.
Okay. Yeah.
But there was data available through naked eye measurements, extensively through a man named Tycho Brahe.
I've heard of him.
You know, he was a Danish nobleman. He made astronomical observations over several decades, and near the end of his life, he built an observatory in Prague, now in the Czech Republic, where he made meticulous observations of the heavens.
Okay.
And Kepler knew this. Kepler reached out to Brahe and said, I'd like to see some of that data to help me support my work. And in 1600, Brahe actually asked him to come work with him in Prague, and he did. Oh. Yeah,
scientists are good people.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you the rest of the story.
Oh, okay. Something bad's going to happen.
But yeah, Brahe became suspicious of Kepler's motives and refused then to share his work. But then, interestingly, a year later, Brahe died. And that, again, is another podcast episode. It's amazing how he died. He had like a prosthetic nose. He got in a sword fight.
I'd seen that, a picture of him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Kepler had access to all this data. And the family of Brahe, which could have made tons of money on this, didn't know how valuable it was. And so Kepler took ownership of it prior to recognizing the value.
Oh, my.
Now, there was a conspiracy theory that Brahe was poisoned by Kepler using mercury.
Okay.
And this was because Brahe's body was exhumed in 1901 because they wanted to find out whether he actually had a prosthetic gold nose or something else.
Okay.
And it turns out that the testing showed he had a high level of mercury in his body.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, Kepler was then thought of being a murderer. They thought he murdered him, you know.
But now, couldn't have been other reasons, too, right? I mean, but go ahead.
Yeah, so but it is interesting. He was, like, really thought of as possibly doing this. Mm-hmm. And in 2010, this is, like, 100 years after the first exhumation, they exhumed his body again and found out that the mercury wasn't all that high. So it took a century for Kepler to not be a murder suspect anymore. Now, he was already dead and so on. But
Right.
So in addition to this interesting fact, Kepler also acted as his mother's counsel during a trial for which he was accused of witchcraft by somebody who didn't like her and thought, I can't remember the details of it, but she was accused of being a witch. And he did successfully defend her, but she was in prison for over a year before she was released. Yeah.
Wow.
And then other interesting things, Kepler's astrological calendars, you know, based on like where things were in the heavens, were so popular that he made tons of money on them. And it allowed him to fund his other work. This is like how he got money. One of the ways he got money.
Was common for a lot of scientists.
Yeah, we needed to have either like somebody who was your patron or some other way of getting the money.
Right.
And supposedly his predictions were so accurate based on astrology that people bought these things up like crazy. Hmm. But most people say that it was the reason why they were accurate because he was like an astute observer of human beings and was able to make like things that were predictive of like politics and other things. But he got in trouble because one of his predictions got this famous politician really mad. So they burned his last astrological calendar like in the public square.
Oh my gosh.
And so he was kind of getting in trouble for some of that sort of stuff too. But it's important that we put Kepler's work in the historical context of all these things we were talking about, you know, like witchcraft. I don't know if you remember too, Galileo was placed under house arrest during Kepler's lifetime.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. He had a pretty palatial place to stay.
Yeah, but still he had to stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really nerve-wracking, I think, you know. So, you know, this is the Catholic Church kind of supporting the older Aristotelian ideas.
Right.
But Kepler was like really religious, and so he was careful not to upset the church.
Okay.
And then Galileo was probably put under house arrest for more than just his support of Copernicus. It's because he made fun of people in the church too. Like one of his publications had like this daffy priest who wasn't able to keep up with the scientists.
And sure.
So it kind of made the church look bad.
Yeah.
So since Kepler was kind of religious, he was careful about that. But he went so far as to create a code so that when he and his wife corresponded by letter, they could say things without getting in trouble. So he was aware.
Yeah.
You follow what I mean? But it's kind of weird.
Yeah. It's so funny. Lucky he didn't live in today's day and age. Everything would be overheard. And
I know.
He probably wouldn't have a cell phone.
I kind of want to talk about that. And this actually brings us full circle to the concept of inertia. Because, you know, in addition to this physical principle of inertia and the cognitive inertia we talked about, there's also kind of like a cultural inertia, right? They kept Galileo and Kepler and Newton from really expressing themselves perhaps fully. Like they had to be super careful.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty obvious based on what we've described that all of us might feel that way, right? To be more careful about
it. Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Because Aristotle's ideas were accepted for over 2,000 years.
Right.
I mean, that's a good example of inertia, right? He thought that objects had natural resting places.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of corresponded with things that were found in the Old Testament and so on that the church kind of adopted.
Right.
Aristotle was a fan of geocentrism, which the church adopted. He thought that things in orbit up in space went in perfectly circular orbits as a reflection of the perfection of the universe, which, you know, theologically might be a nice thing to
consider. I always wondered, though, when you look up at night at the moon, you could see that it's not perfect. You see like little like pock marks. And even,
well, you know, Galileo looked at that quite a lot.
Yeah,
you know, the differences in this perfect sphere and so on that was
out
there. You know, these ideas then, in a sense, have a kind of inertia on their own that's difficult to overcome and actually dangerous to challenge sometimes.
Sure.
It makes us to consider, kind of like you just anticipated what I was going to say, of what happens in today's world, you know, and the value that we sometimes put on just maintaining the standard ways of thinking rather than being a force against that and trying to make things progress, mm-hmm. and how hard that can be, you know, on a personal level.
Yes.
So yeah. I'm just going to close here with just a few of Kepler's quotes that I think are instructive in this regard. You know, he said that I much prefer, and these are in his books, I much prefer the sharpest criticism of a single intelligent man than the thoughtless approval of the masses.
Mm.
You think that has a lot to do with it,
yes.
don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah.
He also said something that had like kind of a feminist overview, point of view. He said, truth is the daughter of time, and I feel no shame in being its midwife.
Mm. Yeah.
Kind of cool, right?
Definitely not a demagogue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. And then the last thing I'll say is, shortly before his death, he wrote his own epitaph that he wanted to put on his gravesite.
Okay.
And it says this, I used to measure the skies. Now I measure the shadows of the earth. Although my mind was skybound, the shadow of my body lies here.
Mm-hmm.
And if I may, I could add that due to inertia, it'll stay there in the absence of an external force.
There you go.
Hey, thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This has been MySciencePrep.com's Chemistry and Physics Podcast. It was produced in Pittsburgh, PA. Visit myscience-prep.com for more episodes.